you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on Patreon or Teespring if you feel inclined. Our guest today is Joe Langan. Joe is a PhD candidate and a Population and Ecosystem Dynamics Fellow in the National Marine Fisheries Service Sea Grant Joint Fellowship Program at the University of Rhode Island Graduate School of Oceanography. He received his undergraduate education from the University of New England in Maine, where he double majored in marine science and mathematics and participated in research on the post-release mortality of Atlantic cod caught by rod and reel and commercial lobster gear. He is now currently pursuing a PhD in biological oceanography, advised by Jeremy Cawley, and a master's degree in statistics, advised by Gavino Pugliani. His research broadly focuses on understanding how interactions of climate effects and fishing activities impact marine ecosystems. Welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Hey, thanks. I'm excited to be here.
Did I read that right, that you are earning both your master's and PhD at the same time?
Yeah, I've been working on both degree programs since I started graduate school.
Is that just a longer amount of time in school, or do you have to take a few extra courses every semester?
In my case, the master's ended up adding 6 more classes and a thesis, so a bit more work, but I'm trying to wrap both up in a total of 6 years.
Many people in the field of fisheries have a fairly good understanding, or at least they consider a good understanding in statistics and dabble in it frequently to do research projects. But not many actually chase it as a double major or a full-on graduate degree in math or statistics. What led you down that path?
Yeah, it wasn't something I planned on. So when I was kind of going into undergrad, I had always kind of done well in math in school, but never really loved it. But I had some college credits from high school courses going in, and thought, you know, maybe I'll do a math minor or something. It'll kind of look good on my resume, make me more attractive when I go to enter the job market down the line. But I got to campus at UNE and talked with my new advisor, and he said, you know, you have these credits already. You've always done well in math. Why don't you try to do a double major? And this is kind of freshman me, about 2 weeks into school, not really having planned on that, but also not necessarily wanting to tell my new advisor no. So I said, okay, let me just go talk to the math department and figure it out. And so I went to talk to the math department chair, and they walked me through it and made it sound so interesting and not scary. And so then, you know, very early in my first semester of college, ended up as a math major, ended up actually loving it. UNE had a kind of combined, or they were transitioning rather from a pure math program to an applied math program. So I took kind of a combination of theory classes like abstract algebra, as well as more applied classes like applied statistics. And from all of that, found I really liked the applied angle, really enjoyed learning and thinking about kind of these quantitative approaches to apply to fisheries, which has always been kind of my first interest. And so then when it was time to go to graduate school, I set out actually wanting to find a program where I could do both, where I could do a PhD in fisheries or fisheries related field, do fisheries research, as well as do a master's in stats. And so I'm lucky enough that I found kind of a home here at GSO with 2 advisors who are super supportive and let me do that. And so, you know, I always thought I'd at least want to take a bunch of stats classes as a graduate student, and then figured if I was going to do that, then I might as well try to go for the full master's.
In all of your math classes, did you ever have the one stereotypical one where they fill the whole chalkboard with an equation?
Yeah, to some degree. I think the class a lot of math majors dread is called real analysis, which is all like proof-based, proving a bunch of pretty abstract concepts. And yeah, we'd have like proofs and equations kind of going across the whole chalkboard. So yeah, I've kind of earned my stripes with that.
Your master's degree will be in statistics, but it's still doing some fisheries work, specifically looking to improve forecasting of stock biomass of New England groundfish. How exactly are you going about doing that?
Yeah, so what we are doing is trying to kind of construct a model with better forecasting ability for some of our New England groundfish stocks. So groundfish just refers to marine fish that kind of hang out near the seafloor. So think like cod, haddock, pollock, flounder, that kind of stuff. So in New England, for those who might not be familiar, we kind of have the backbone of all of our assessments of fish populations being a big trawl survey done by the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. So they go out in the spring and in the fall and do a few hundred trawls between Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, and Nova Scotia. The idea being that if you have a bunch of samples from roughly the entire spatial range of a species, you can get a decent estimate of total population abundance. So we supplement that with some other surveys done by different states and kind of feed that into management models. So the best version when we know a lot about a species is called an age-structured model, or we call it Plan A, for exactly the reason you would expect, where we actually have a model that deals with each age class of the fish as they move through the population and how fishing is harvesting from each of those ages. And this model produces a ton of information. For those species that we have less information about, they're called Plan B or index-based. The models are much, much more simplistic, and they just kind of try to track the abundance changes over time in that trawl survey. So for the age-structured, the Plan A models, a problem that's persisted in New England is some of them, for some species, seem to kind of persistently produce a biased forecast. And they'll do this over and over. And so the problem is we make a forecast, we set our harvest levels accordingly, we catch those fish for the next few years, do another stock assessment, and now realize, oh, whoops, you know, we overfished for the last 3 years. Populations decline, now we need to cut harvest. So that's something you want to avoid. For those index-based species, there's not even really a consensus way to forecast right now. They kind of do a few different methods, some things like kind of smoothing, just trying to understand what's the current abundance level of these fish, and then, you know, are they going down, are they going up, should we catch more or less, that kind of thing. So that's kind of the primer. What we wanted to do then is say, okay, these stock assessment models, particularly in that age-structured case, produce a bunch of very valuable information we certainly need for managing these marine fisheries, but they have some problems specifically just in this forecasting part. So what if we build a model that is only optimized for forecasting? We only care about forecast accuracy and let these other models kind of do the rest of this work and produce these different metrics we need for fisheries management. So to do that, we're using a technique called dynamic linear models in a Bayesian framework. And so dynamic linear models are kind of like a linear regression model most of us in fishery science would be used to fitting, except the different coefficients and parameters can change over time, which makes them extremely flexible and very, very cool. And so what this allows us to do is kind of relax some assumptions we have to make about a fish population. So for example, when you harvest from a fish population, the effect of that harvest on the population, so say the effect of catching 100 metric tons, is going to matter more or less depending upon the actual population size. If you catch 100 metric tons from a population of 1,000 metric tons, that's a big deal. If you catch 100 metric tons from a population of 50,000 metric tons, not really a big deal. So in an age-structured model, if you have the data to do this, you actually try to estimate fishing mortality. So what's the rate of mortality generated by fishing, and how does that change over time? If you don't have the information to do that, you can't really incorporate catch in that way. You can't build a model that kind of makes predictions based upon catch levels. And so a dynamic linear model, we kind of get around this problem where instead of estimating the fishing mortality rate, which requires you to estimate the actual fish population abundance, we allow for the effect of catch on the population to change over time. And so this is an example of kind of the flexible way these models allow us to get around some of these issues where, say, for example, we don't have enough data or there's a lot of uncertainty in some of our data. And then you can stack these up into a full age structured model where we have basically a dynamic linear model for each age that kind of sequentially feed into each other. You can make them multi-species. You can also incorporate environmental information. So it's a very cool modeling framework.
It definitely sounds a lot more complicated than I'd be able to figure out.
It's less hard than you would think from the initial description, but yeah, they're very, very cool, and it's been producing some really promising results.
So then when this forecasting tool is finished, are you hoping to have multiple different agencies begin to use it?
It's definitely for fishery managers. So we are working currently directly with the New England Fishery Management Council, who sets the regulations for our region. I've been kind of keeping them posted and getting their feedback along the way as we develop these models. And so ultimately, I'm going to generate our code and put it up on GitHub for folks to use. And while we're building this specifically for this problem with New England groundfish, there's no reason it can't be used in kind of any system where you have some measure of fish abundance over time, whether that's a survey abundance. So in the marine realm, that could be a trawl survey, a trap survey for crustacean, maybe an electrofishing survey in freshwater, or catch per unit effort data even for kind of cases where you only have information on stock abundance from what the fishermen are bringing in.
For your dissertation work, the other half of your school experience, you are looking at understanding the decline of winter flounder in the Narragansett Bay. First of all, what has led to their decline?
So this one's tricky, and a lot of people have been working on it for a while. So for those who aren't familiar, winter flounder are kind of a little coastal flounder species. They don't get too big. They top out around 50 centimeters or so. That rely on estuaries or at least inshore waters for spawning and don't tend to go too far offshore. And so there's a lot of history in New England fishing for this species. Here in Rhode Island, I talk to fishermen all the time who tell me how in the 60s, 70s, and into the early 80s, it seemed like Narragansett Bay was paved with winter flounder. They would talk about how as a kid, they'd go down to a dock and fish off that dock for just 2 hours and fill a 5-gallon bucket full of big flounder to bring home, almost at the catch rate you would expect if you're targeting, say, bluegill in a pond. But according to some trawl data we have in Narragansett Bay, this population locally within Rhode Island waters has declined by about 99% since the early 1980s. So we've seen a very severe decline that is kind of mirrored region-wide. And so as this decline has been ongoing throughout southern New England, the managers have kept dialing back harvest and dialing back harvest, and the population has not recovered. And so what that has led us to believe is that something's going on in those early life stages. There's extra mortality happening when these fish are young, before they enter the fishery, that is actually kind of causing this problem.
And then what kind of work are you doing on your dissertation to help understand this decline?
So in Rhode Island waters, we're really lucky to have some exceptional data sets. So first, the URI Grad School of Oceanography has been running a weekly fish trawl survey since 1959. So nearly every week of every year, we go out and trawl two locations in Narragansett Bay, giving us unprecedented temporal resolution for studying marine fish. As far as we know, it's actually the longest continuous trawl survey of its kind. We've never had a gap of more than a couple of months. So we have that. We also have surveys done by the state. They do trawl surveys throughout Narragansett Bay on a monthly basis, as well as through the rest of Rhode Island waters seasonally. They do a seine survey to catch the juveniles. And we even have long-term information on winter flounder larval abundance. So when they're just in the planktonic stage, from required environmental monitoring by power plants on Narragansett Bay that actually rely on intake water to cool the actual plant. And as part of their monitoring, they have to keep track of the abundance of different fish larvae that are effectively kind of getting sucked up. And so we have all this data. So what we're able to do is construct a life cycle model where we have about 30 years of data on each life stage going through the life cycle. So eggs, larvae, we have two life stages during the first year of life. We have then spring age one, fall age one, et cetera, going up into the spawning size. And so we fit this life cycle model with a system, well, with a structural equation model, which is just a system of linear connected equations. And our goal here is to kind of see where the off-ramp is. So we've set up our life cycle. We know exactly what the life cycle looks like. So you just kind of fit that statistically. And you look at where there's a bunch of extra variation in your data you can't explain. So extra variation that isn't explained by this kind of neat transition from one life stage to the next can be extra mortality. So looking at which life stage do we kind of see fish going missing? And what we see is it can be throughout the early life stages, but appears to be particularly in the first year of life. So the next step then was to introduce covariates into the model to check what could be causing this, what covariates, whether it be temperature or fishing or something, explain that extra variance that our model initially wasn't able to explain. And we're still kind of tying things up, but it looks like it's kind of climate effects both directly and indirectly, where summer temperature is a problem. Winter flounder don't like it super hot. And so as we're getting hotter and hotter summers, that seems to be posing a problem for these H0 fish, as well as what goes along with that often, in our case, low dissolved oxygen. So in Narragansett Bay, we have some areas that get really stratified and stagnant in the summer, and we can get hypoxic zones on the bottom where the flounder are. We also see that predation by a warm water fish called striped sea robin is potentially playing a role, as well as predation from a protected water bird species called the double-crested cormorant that have increased substantially since the 1980s due to federal protection. So now we know kind of where in the life cycle these fish are going missing. We have some candidates for kind of the whodunit question. So the next steps and what I'm finishing up now, as we turn that structural equation model forward and use it to forecast into the future, where we use global climate models produced by the IPCC to project what our temperature might look like for the next 50 years or so. And then we can also say, well, what'll happen if striped sea robin abundance increases by 20% or decreases by 20% or something like that. And so what we see so far is that kind of regardless of what you do with striped sea robin or hypoxia levels or even cormorants, it looks like summer temperatures are going to keep increasing to the point where they're going to result in continued declining productivity of winter flounder in coastal Rhode Island waters. By around the mid-2030s to 2040s is what it's looking like right now. We're still kind of tying up some model loose ends. So we know what is going on in the life cycle. We kind of have some candidates for whodunit. We projected this forward. And then the last part of my dissertation is to kind of look at the spatial part of this. So the structural equation model tells us about the population dynamics, but I wanted to also learn about what's going on with their habitat use patterns. Do we see these fish changing how they're using these habitats in Rhode Island waters? Are they, you know, more abundant in certain parts of the bay than they used to? Have they abandoned other areas? Do we see them moving in or out of Narragansett Bay at different times? So for that, we fit a spatiotemporal model of their habitat use in Narragansett Bay. And what we see is that as this population's declined, they've kind of contracted into very specific concentrated areas of Narragansett Bay. And we also see evidence that the older fish are spending less time in the estuary. So they're using less spatial habitat and less temporal habitat in Rhode Island waters.
You mentioned some effects of climate change there. And a few weeks ago, we had Dr. Scott Bonar on to talk briefly about climate change and how it's affecting fisheries. But you've also been a part of some work regarding climate change on another species. What can you tell us about the Atlantic cod?
Yeah, so Atlantic cod is kind of the big one here in New England. It's a hugely, hugely historic fishery that was massively productive for a few hundred years until its more recent severe decline. So it's kind of my entry into cod. As you mentioned in the intro, I kind of cut my teeth as an undergrad helping out on some projects regarding cod. I worked with a graduate student to better understand how, when you catch cod on rod and reel, if you release them, does that fish actually survive? And what's the probability it actually survives? And what does that mean for how we need to set harvest regulations? And then I also, funnily enough, rented a house from a lobsterman who told me that he caught a bunch of Atlantic cod in his lobster traps, which I didn't know was a concern. And so I worked with him to collect some data and kind of helped kick off a project that another graduate student took the reins on to actually see how cod survive when they get caught in a lobster trap and then thrown overboard. But throughout this work, I was kind of in the midst of the decline and kind of collapse of cod in the Gulf of Maine, where their population severely, severely declined. And we had to severely cut harvest in New England, as well as talk about different expanded closed areas for fishing and all these other regulations. So I'm used to thinking of cod in this context of this population in decline, due both to overfishing, as well as some known climate effects on their population dynamics. We know that as waters warm, they're losing thermal habitat, they're changing their distribution, their prey field is changing, and temperature and warming through direct and indirect effects can also really increase juvenile mortality, right from larvae up through those kind of early life stages. So I come down to Rhode Island now, and I'm doing my work on winter flounder, and we did a larval survey for larval winter flounder in Narragansett Bay. And we caught a whole bunch of cod larvae inside Narragansett Bay. This is, you know, usually they're spawning offshore, and we don't think of their juveniles settling in estuaries, but we caught larvae all the way up into the city limits of Providence at the very head of Narragansett Bay, and thought this was super weird. And at the same time, fishermen were telling us that they were had the best cod fishing offshore that they'd seen in decades. Now, southern New England, right, you know, where Rhode Island's right in the middle of, is the southern extreme of the global range of Atlantic cod. So this is kind of the front line for cod confronting climate change, where we have very warm waters in the summer. And so we would have expected them to be declining here, but the fishermen were telling us that wasn't true. And I, you know, after coming from Maine, I said, no way, like, what's going on here? We're catching a bunch of larvae inshore. Fishermen are saying they're catching a bunch of cod. We need to figure this out. So we kind of pulled together every data set we could think of from the Rhode Island area, whether it's those trawl surveys I mentioned inside Narragansett Bay, or recreational fishing statistics for Rhode Island, or commercial landings from vessel trip reports for Rhode Island, and tried to set out on this project to say, okay, when and where do we see cod in Rhode Island waters? Are they really increasing like the fishermen claim? And do we see any evidence of these expected negative relationships with climate change? So the answers to that were cod are still definitely here in Rhode Island, and we see them tight inshore when it's cold. Yes, they absolutely have increased in abundance since the year 2000. And we still do see the expected negative relationships with climate change, where we saw evidence that they were losing thermal habitat. And we saw a very strong negative relationship between the number of juvenile age zero cod we caught in our surveys and the winter water temperature. So that kind of even raised more questions of, okay, we see more cod in Rhode Island, but they're having problems with increasing temperature. We see this negative relationship with winter temperature, yet they've increased anyway during a period where we had 6 of our 10 warmest winters on record. What is going on there? And the answer is still, I don't know, to be honest. And so we've kind of expanded into some other work. So one of my colleagues here at URI, another graduate student named Nina Santos, is working on better understanding how cod are fitting into our local food web. And we're also trying to launch some work too to understand how our cod population here in southern New England relates and connects to other cod throughout New England waters.
I would imagine that increasing numbers of Atlantic cod could have a negative impact on other fishes in the Narragansett Bay that have a niche or dietary overlap, or perhaps they're preyed upon. Do you have any of Nina's results that you could share with us?
Yes, I do. So she's found some really cool stuff. So our cod are kind of, just kind of set the stage, like come in, some fish will come in close to coastal waters. We'll even catch them just inside Narragansett Bay in the winter months. And then they appear to spend the summer on offshore banks, but not that far offshore. They're say 10, 15 miles from the south coast of Rhode Island and not that far from Block Island or Martha's Vineyard or those other kind of islands in the area. And so she's been doing both diet work and some stable isotope analyses. So the diet work is to understand, okay, what are they eating? What are the prey resources that they're accessing here that's supporting an increase in population, as well as, you know, what populations do we need to maybe think about cod as a predator for? And then on the stable isotope side, she's comparing the kind of trophic positioning of cod to another abundant species in Rhode Island waters, the black sea bass, which I believe you talked about on a previous episode of the podcast. So black sea bass are a small fish in the grouper family that back in the 60s, their distribution was centered off kind of the Chesapeake Bay, Delaware Bay area. And since then has moved up to where the highest densities of black sea bass on the coast are basically south of Rhode Island. So we have this warm water fish moving in. They're super, super abundant. And we thought maybe they might be competing with cod. So what does the resurgence of cod mean for our black sea bass fishery? And kind of conversely, what does this increasing predator competitor abundance rather mean for cod? Can they sustain this increased abundance level, or do we expect them to decline? So what Nina's found is the cod appear to be primarily eating small cancer crabs. So Jonah rock crabs, these are crabs related to Dungeness crabs from the West Coast, which people seem to be more familiar with. Now, this is kind of a relevant fishery concern because the lobster fishery has severely declined in southern New England as temperatures have risen. And a lot of our lobstermen have now switched over to harvesting cancer crabs. And so now we have these cod coming in, eating a ton of the juvenile cancer crabs. But what Nina's also found is that the black sea bass are also eating a lot of these juvenile cancer crabs as well. And so when she looks at her isotope data, she's still kind of finishing up, but it looks like these fish are kind of direct competitors, or at least they are eating a lot of the same things in Rhode Island waters, which again raises more questions of how have cod managed to increase in abundance when they have all these different climate impacts, whether it be direct temperature effects on their life cycle, or in terms of increasing the number of competitors they have to deal with to get their prey.
Seems like a perplexing issue out there. Is there any more research going on looking into why they're increasing in numbers?
Yeah, so there's a few different things. First, some folks over at UMass Dartmouth at the School of Marine Science and Technology are working on a survey of cod spawning off southern New England and Rhode Island, trying to understand when and where exactly are they spawning. It's very cool. They use both an acoustic array and gliders produced by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution to listen for the grunts that cod make as part of their spawning behavior, as well as tagging some fish with acoustic transmitters that can get picked up so we know kind of where these fish are at different times of year, as well as, you know, when do we hear and where do we hear this evidence of spawning activity going on. Then we are also working on trying to find some money here at URI to do some expanded genetics work. We took a bunch of samples from larval and adult cod. We want to know how our cod genetically relate to other parts of U.S. waters. Some work's already been done on that that actually suggests southern New England cod are probably genetically distinct, and the difference appears to be coming in the heat shock proteins. So the proteins having to do with temperature tolerance, which is super interesting given that this is kind of the southern warmest group of cod we have in the U.S. And so we're trying to kind of contribute to expanding that genetic analysis further and see if we see any evidence of larvae from other parts of U.S. waters drifting into Rhode Island and then settling here. Or is it that all of these larvae we're seeing are just from local spawning kind of in and south of Rhode Island? And then finally, we're also kind of working on some work with an undergrad right now doing image analysis to see if our southern New England cod actually have a different body shape than other groups of cod in U.S. waters. So, you know, if the genetics are different, perhaps we can actually see a difference physically. And so that's still super, super early going, but at least comparing to cod out on George's Bank, which is a shallow submarine plateau kind of sticking out to the northeast of Cape Cod, we do see that there might actually be a difference in body shape between the two groups, which is very, very interesting.
Back along the climate change issues, you've also been a part of some work looking at how changes in ocean circulation affected the marine ecosystem. Is there good news there?
Depends on who you ask. So on our kind of northeast U.S. shelf, we've seen, which is defined as Cape Hatteras to Nova Scotia, we've seen extremely rapid warming in the past few decades. The Gulf of Maine specifically has been noted to be warming faster than almost anywhere else in the world oceans. So recent research by some physicists in the region suggests that only about a third of that warming is actually coming from climate change. The other two thirds is due to shifts in ocean circulation. So our major currents impacting our temperature here are the Gulf Stream, which is a super warm, salty current that kind of originates around between Florida and Cuba and shoots up the U.S. East Coast through Atlantic Canada and then off across the Atlantic Ocean toward the U.K. and Europe. And the Labrador Current, which is a cold, less salty current that comes down from Greenland, wraps around Atlantic Canada, and can kind of shoot off some water into New England waters. And so when we have a lot of water kind of getting pumped down from the Labrador Current, our shelf water is relatively cool and less salty. When we have a lot of Gulf Stream influence, it gets a lot warmer and saltier very quickly. And so some work I've kind of followed along on with some physicists here at URI, Jamie Falter and Afonso Goncalves, has actually suggested that most of the warming, at least on the northern half of the Northeast U.S. shelf, so Georgia's Bank, Gulf of Maine North, is attributed to two big shifts in ocean circulation, one in the 70s and one in the late 2000s, where effectively the Gulf Stream moved north and cut off water from the Labrador Current from getting into New England. And so bringing this back to fish, looking at this trawl data set we have in Rhode Island waters, we're able to look at how fish migration timings are changing. So most of our marine species we catch in coastal Rhode Island waters don't spend all year here. A lot of them go to the outer continental shelf for part of the year. So for species that like warm water, they'll go offshore in the winter where it's warmer and we get kind of that less winter mixing of cold water down to the bottom. For species that like cold water, they'll go offshore in the summer to kind of retreat from the heat. And so usually in marine fish, we can't measure changes in migration very well because it's hard. In freshwater, you could, for example, tag a bunch of fish with acoustic transmitters that, let's say, migrate up and down a river, and maybe you could put transmitters across the river or something and kind of pick them up as they move back and forth. It's a lot harder in the ocean where the fish can kind of go and come from any which way. But using this weekly trawl data in Narragansett Bay, we were able to show that the timing of these inshore-offshore migrations of these species have actually shifted by months in many cases, where they're showing up, say, a month earlier and leaving 2 months later or something on that order, which is a huge change for the local food web. We have very different species and different abundances here at different times than they used to be. And what's more is we saw that the timing of those changing in migrations was very closely tied to temperature, which is influenced by this ocean circulation. And so as we have our waters warming and as we have these shifts in ocean circulation putting more warm water into coastal New England, we've seen that basically species that like warm water come inshore much earlier, are much more abundant, and then leave much later in the fall. And then reverse, we've seen cold water species come inshore much later, be in much lower abundance and leave much earlier, and in some cases have just kind of disappeared from Rhode Island waters entirely.
We talked a little bit earlier about your dissertation work being on winter flounder or focusing on winter flounder, but you've also done a little work with summer flounder. And being a landlocked Midwesterner, these are foreign fish to me. So what is the difference between the two?
In New England, literally that one's abundant in the summer and the other's abundant in the winter. That's how they got their names, but to be more precise, winter flounder are part of the family Pleuronectidae. So this is the same family as plaice and halibut, which are called the right eye flounders. So I think a lot of people know that flounder have both eyes on one side of their head. But what they might not know is depending upon the taxonomic grouping of flounder, those eyes might be on the right side of the head or on the left side. So we call it the eye side and the blind side. You can tell which side the eye side is if you hold the fish kind of vertically, so its mouth is facing upward, which kind of side of the fish are the eyes on. So on winter flounder, that's the right side. On summer flounder, it's the left. They're part of the family Paralichthyidae, which are called like the large-toothed flounders. So they have kind of a big predatory mouth, jaw structure, big sharp teeth. They kind of are ambush predators picking fish and squid out of the water column from above them, where winter flounder have this tiny little mouth they use to kind of pick worms or clam siphons or that sort of stuff out of the benthos. So they're kind of just different species of flounder, but they've been named because summer flounder like this warm water. So they kind of come in. They're one of these fish I studied the migrations of. They come into New England in the summer and are now coming way earlier and leaving way later than they used to. Winter flounder spawn in the winter. So the adults push into inshore waters during the coldest months of the year, and that's when they're most abundant.
And you just mentioned that you studied the migration patterns of the summer flounders, and you mentioned in an email that you found some differences between males and females. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, so summer flounder are one of the flatfish, and there are many, that are what's called sexually dimorphic, meaning that males and females look different. In the case of summer flounder, females grow faster and to a larger ultimate size. So that's very important when we think about fisheries regulations, because fishermen generally want to catch the bigger fish. Recreational fishermen, of course, are usually targeting the biggest fish they can find. And for commercial fishermen, they actually get a higher price per pound on larger flounder when they bring them back to the dock. So in our case, those larger flounder are almost all female, especially if you're fishing close to the coast. And so that raises a lot of questions for stock assessment, because of course, in terms of fish productivity, we really only care about those females producing eggs. We don't need as many males, but if the fishing effort's being mostly focused on the females as opposed to a 50-50 split, that kind of changes how we need to approach things. So there was some research team down at Rutgers led by Jason Morrison, who had put out papers a few years ago looking at how recreational fishermen and charter boat fishermen, what proportions of male and female summer flounder were they catching. And they saw that they were really harvesting a lot of female fish. But in their data, they saw kind of a hint that maybe female and summer flounder were just in different spatial areas. They were seeing some evidence that fishing in one area caught a lot more female flounder than in a different area along the coast of New Jersey. But from this kind of fisheries data from the boats, they couldn't fully tell what was going on. So this was one of those serendipitous situations where we were sitting there and saw this paper and realized with these trawl surveys in Rhode Island waters, we could answer this question kind of with the resources at hand. So we collected about 1,200 summer flounder in 2016 and 2017 and recorded where we caught them and what the depth was, what the temperature was, and put a summer undergrad on it, Adina Schoenfeld, who's now down at Virginia Institute of Marine Science for her PhD, to see, do we see evidence that these males and females are in different areas? The answer is absolutely. Females, for whatever reason, appear to prefer shallower water. And it didn't look exactly like they're necessarily following a particular temperature, but it really was that the females were just consistently in shallower water. We also saw some evidence that males might migrate offshore in the fall a little bit earlier, as well as older fish. We saw predominantly young fish first thing in the spring and last to exit the bay in the fall, where most of those big adult spawning size fish were caught kind of in the middle of the summer. So it appears that not only do we have this situation where we have to think about size differences between male and female summer flounder, but where you're fishing may make an enormous difference in what ratio of the two sexes you catch. Between our two URI trawl stations, for example, which are only 15 kilometers apart, the shallower station, we caught about 2-to-1 females to males. At the deeper station, we caught about 1.1 males to females. So we saw the ratio completely start to flip the other way.
Well, Joe, it certainly sounds like you have your hands full with a lot of great projects going on out there in Rhode Island. And on top of all that great work, you also lead or take part in some efforts to inform the public about all these projects that you and your colleagues are working on. So what kind of science communication projects are you a part of exactly?
Yeah, so I participate in two. One is called the Bay Informed Discussion Series. The other is called Narragansett Bay Classroom. So Bay Informed is a lecture series completely put on and given by graduate students. Back in 2017 or so, a bunch of us were kind of seeing these federal budgets coming out, not to make it political, but when we saw a bunch of our funding kind of potentially on the chopping block, it woke a lot of us up that we need to do more as young scientists to kind of share our science with the public. It's not enough to just kind of put out our papers. We need to not only make efforts to share our research with the public, but develop those skills in presenting to a public audience as opposed to giving a super technical, concise, dense presentation in a conference setting. And so we got together and started Bay Informed, which is a monthly public lecture series where we just bring whoever wants to come to campus of our local community. We try to advertise all over, try to get some school groups to come, and just have graduate students talk about their research. I've been super lucky to be at the Graduate School of Oceanography, where I look around me and see students doing unbelievable research, where we have people going to Antarctica on research expeditions each year. Right now, there's people from GSO on a research ship locked in sea ice in the Arctic as part of the Mosaic expedition, with people studying seafloor microbes to make guesses about what life on other planets might look like. There's all these super interesting topics beyond just fish, what I think is the most interesting, that all these people are working on. So we really wanted to kind of bring that to the public and tell them what we do and how we do it, and also provide that platform for graduate students to work on communicating with a public audience and kind of developing those more casual presentation skills to try to kind of increase the public reach of their research. So we have kind of paused, obviously, in our public lectures due to the pandemic. And now we're actually starting to pivot toward developing an oceanography podcast. So I've been taking notes this whole time, for sure. And we hope to get some of those episodes started up maybe this fall. The Narragansett Bay Classroom is kind of an outreach effort led by the Grad School of Oceanography and some of our folks in the Office of Marine Programs to basically access this graduate student expertise they have to teach marine science to local K-12 school kids. And so these are a ton of fun. Basically, we meet the kids somewhere in the field, or if the weather's bad or it's the winter time, we will go to their classrooms and kind of do a hands-on activity in the classroom. But most of the time we're going out to a salt pond, a salt marsh, the beach, and teaching the kids about biology, geology, physics, whatever it may be, depending on which graduate students are there that day. So it might be a physicist teaching them about how waves shape ocean beaches, or a geologist telling them about the sand and the rock formations. Or in my case, as a biologist, I tend to kind of set them loose to catch anything they can find, crabs, fish, worms, shellfish, whatever. And then we talk about all of these organisms and how they fit together in our local food web to kind of give the students a better hands-on understanding of what organisms are here in Rhode Island, in their backyard, and what are they doing there? What do they eat? What do they grow? Which ones are important for fisheries? Which ones are important for monitoring climate change? That sort of thing.
I'm sure in both settings you get some pretty interesting questions thrown you or your colleagues' way. What are some of the more memorable questions that you've received from the two different groups?
In the lecture series, I'm not sure if I can remember a specific question off the top of my head, but it's interesting, and I'm sure anyone listening who's done a lot of public speaking and public presentation of science has had similar experiences where, you know, you're always trying to make sure you're not boring the audience, but also not losing anybody. And it's always interesting to me how we get super specific questions about the talk and also something like really tangential. So as a fisheries biologist, and I'm sure a lot of folks, whether they're marine or freshwater biologists, can relate, you know, you'll be presenting on some species, let's say Atlantic cod, and somebody will raise their hand and say, oh, I saw this one fish or shellfish, you know, on vacation sometime in this place that I don't really remember where it is. Can you tell me what it was? And so you have to kind of think on your feet and think about how to answer questions like that. I always find interesting. With the kids, it's usually, you know, I'm doing the biology stuff, so I get a lot of, are there sharks here? Am I going to get eaten? Can this crab pinch me, like, as it's hanging from the kid's hand? You never know what you're going to get with kids.
Well, the tough part of the interview is over, and we're down to the final five questions, so some of these questions might be just as weird as some you've gotten in some of those classroom or discussion series, but this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
So my partner's last name is actually fish. So I will tell you what my second favorite fish are to avoid getting in trouble. And I'll give you one for freshwater and one for saltwater. So I grew up casting dry flies to trout at the headwaters of the Delaware River and in New York. And I just always remember fishing in kind of these idyllic, beautiful river conditions in the mountains where you can't see any houses or anything for miles, and catching a native brook trout, and just they're super colorful and living in these pristine habitats that I've always really, really loved. And then from the salt, I would say probably Atlantic cod. I'm kind of a sucker for history, and they played such an important role in the development of kind of our early economy and trade here in New England. And then they're a super interesting fish to research now, having going through this precipitous population decline and being tied up in climate issues as well.
And what is your favorite memory from your career or schooling so far?
So it's less like one specific memory and kind of a certain kind of memory. As a student, and I'm sure others can relate, I felt like coming up, you know, you think, oh, I'm working with these scientists, whether they be from this other university or from a state agency, and they're all serious. And I love when a bunch of us get out in the field together and get to go fishing for cod or go lobstering or something like that. And you realize that all of us are doing this working in fisheries because we just love the work and love going out and catching these fish and shellfish and seeing them and holding them and seeing who can catch the biggest one or the most. And I always just kind of enjoy when we go out and kind of almost go back to that childhood state of like, this is just so cool. Let's see what we can catch. And then we write some stuff down and actually do science on them later.
Someday down the road, you're going to finish up your time there at University of Rhode Island. So what is your dream job or dream location that you're hoping to land in?
So right now I'm starting to hunt for a postdoc amid a global pandemic. So I think immediately my dream is getting that sorted out. But in the long term, I'm not sure if I have a particular job picked out. Just really want to keep working on kind of this intersection of climate and fisheries management to better understand how we can sustainably manage our fish populations in a very rapidly changing ocean. If I had to pick a location, at least based on the places I've experienced so far, I really loved living in the state of Maine for my undergrad. It's just a beautiful place, and it's such an interesting body of water in the Gulf of Maine, and that there's so many big, historic, super valuable fisheries, but it's also warming so rapidly due to that combination of climate change and ocean circulation. It just, to me, is a super, super compelling area to do fisheries research.
We've highlighted a whole bunch of really fascinating projects that you've been a part of, but I'm sure there's still one or two ideas in the back of your head that you'd like to look into. So if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Money was not an issue. I think I'd want to kind of put out a big sensor or buoy array across the Northeast continental shelf and then tag a whole lot of fish with like miniaturized satellite tags. The problem we have right now is we have these spatial surveys that go out once or twice a year and tell us where the fish were in that particular instant. And we know what the temperature was in that area at that particular point in time. But what's still very unclear is how the temperatures across this vast dynamic region are changing on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis due to weather and ocean circulation and all these other factors, and then how the fish are actually responding to them. What are the fish doing in between all of those surveys? We know they're migrating several hundred kilometers. When are they doing that? At what temperature or what stimulus cues them to do that? Those are kind of the questions I've been trying to think a lot about, and we just don't have the data to answer them right now. So if I had unlimited money and unlimited manpower, I'd want to kind of put out a giant array of oceanographic sensors and tagged fish.
And finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I'd say don't just use statistics, but actually learn statistics. I think no matter how comfortable or not you are with statistics, we've all, you know, gone to a conference or somewhere else and seen somebody present some data analysis that just seems not necessarily correct. And it's often because a lot of us in fisheries, like you said, we all learn stats at different points and different methods for the particular project we're learning on. And I feel like sometimes we get stuck in kind of a situation like the old adage, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you've learned like one particular method or set of methods or taken one stats class, that might skew how you kind of view future data analysis. You might miss super interesting patterns or set up an experiment in a way that could have been better. And so I think it's really important for folks to kind of slow down and also learn what's going on under the hood with these different statistics we all use as fisheries scientists, and understand when and why to use certain methods or other ones, or what methods are out there to deal with that really tricky data set you have. And I think it's kind of important in everyday life too. We've all seen the general public react to weather forecasts or political polls in rather interesting ways. And so I think having a good handle on statistics can help you in everyday life as well.
Well, that's something that I'm most likely guilty of. So I'll take that into consideration. But Joe, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and all the work you've done up there in the Northeast. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Nick. This was a lot of fun. I am on Twitter. My handle is JA_Langan, so JA_LANGAN. And I'm also pretty responsive by email. My email is joseph_langan@uri.edu.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter @FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/FisheriesPodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@TheFisheriesPodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon, or buy some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts or hoodies available on Teespring. I'm Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 86th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, don't just use statistics, learn them.